You are listening to an It Girl Ragdoll podcast, www.itgirlragdoll.com. This podcast contains themes which are not suitable for those below the age of majority. If you are under 18, please stop listening now. My delicious degenerates, and welcome to episode 3 of the It Girl Ragdoll podcast with me, Harper Elliott. So, it's been a while since I did one of these, and I've got a lot to get through, so I think we'll just start. So, as you heard at the beginning, I have some intro music now, which Nobilis Reed of Nobilis Erotica suggested that I add some intro music to make it sound more whole, which is great. I couldn't really find anything that I wanted. What you heard at the beginning is about as close as it gets in the public domain and where I can download. I'm sure I could do more research, but I'm beginning to feel a bit like I'm never going to find exactly what I want. I have to ask someone to write it for me. So, first order of business. Anyone out there listening to my podcast want to write me some intro music that is a sort of classical-ish and a little bit strange, that'd be fantastic to have my own intro. Or you could just do something funny, silly. I'd like to imagine that I'd get loads of requests, answers to this request to head up my podcast. But we'll have to see. I need something new at some point. For now, we'll use what I've got. So, as I said, it's been ages since I podcasted. Mostly just because I've been busy. I'm looking for a job, and I'm back on the dating circuit, I guess it could be. So I am spending most of my time trying to persuade people that I'm really fantastic. Which is fine, you know, I have high enough self-esteem to do that, but it is exhausting, which is why my blog and podcasts have suffered a little bit. But, you know, you win some, you lose some. At least I'm doing this now. But yeah, this is likely to be a slightly scatty podcast, although I'm not a very scatty person, so maybe, you know, it'll all be fine. Having just said that I'm exhausted of doing self-promotion, I actually have a few pieces of kind of self-promotion, but they also promote other people as well, so I don't have to be the sole recipient of any promotion I'm doing. First of all, Filthy Mouths and Evil Tongues, you can find at www.filthymouthsandeviltongues.com, are a all-women out loud erotica reading group who host events, and there is one on the 21st of September in Hoxton. There will be information on my page. They are sponsored by Women's Store, and yeah, so there's information on my page. My work will definitely be there, even if I am not. You should all buy tickets. It's not that expensive. It's really good fun. You know, men are allowed to come, even though it's just women who read. It's a really good event. They're really fun, and Mel Jones is reading her poetry, and you do not want to miss her. She is superb. Second piece of promotion is actually from about, I want to say 14 days ago, so a couple of weeks now. Anyway, if you haven't seen it yet, I have appeared on Red Lion Street again. Red Lion Street is this ongoing illustrated erotic soap opera type blog, which is just filthy and hilarious, and I love it, and I'm sure I've talked about it here before. So I've been on there 3 times, and this is my third and final appearance. It's a little bit weird, but it's really, really good fun. And actually the whole Red Lion Street thing is going to come to an end pretty soon, as it's just 50 chapters long. But, you know, it'll be up there for ages and you can go back and read the whole thing. It really is one of the best blogs that I've come across. So go read it and comment. There's not enough commenting going on around here. And that's true for me as well, actually. But I am correcting my ways. Next piece of promotion. The book that I reviewed on the last podcast, which was Sunstrokes by Kojo Black, is now available as an audiobook, I think I read like two-thirds of one story is narrated by me, so you should definitely go and buy that. You can find it on Waterstones, just type in Sunstrokes and it'll be down there. You heard last episode, sunny, fun, decadent, luxurious, warm, erotica, and read by some really fantastic people. Although I will admit that I haven't heard it yet because, well, I don't know why I haven't heard it yet, but I haven't. Maybe next time I do a podcast, I'll have heard it and I can really review it properly. For now, I could just tell you that it was great fun to record and that it's quite steamy. So you should enjoy that. If you don't want to go to the Waterstones site and search for it yourself, I will provide a link on my site so I make it easy for you. Right, so now I get to relax for a moment and go into my more fun-loving, ranty self. You know how I like to talk. So, the first It Girl Ragdoll podcast, I reviewed 50 Shades of Grey. Much to, I don't know, people liked it and I really enjoyed reviewing it and I was really cruel and I ripped the shit out of it. And although I do think I was fair as well. Anyway, since I did that, you know, I've been tagged in every tweet in my timeline that had to do with 50 Shades of Grey. I've been sent messages, people just talked to me about it. I can't escape it, and I completely brought that on myself, and actually I am doing it again right now, so I have only myself to blame. But I think that the good side of this ongoing thing, well, it's not. It's sort of changing from being the thing that everyone is horrified and angry about, to being something that is spawning so much good humour, and I think people are using it as a stepping stone. You know, when I talk about it with other erotic creatives, it's like, how can we do something off the back of this? Because it's had this huge success and we need to use that. So I do think that the initial anger and stuff is sort of burning out, which is great, despite a few disturbing references to book burning, which I'm always horrified about. Book burning's just, it's not cool by me. Doesn't matter what you're burning, you know, that's literature. But yeah, I mean, mostly I think everyone's settled into this sort of, it's the common joke, you know, you could talk about it to anyone. So there's just sort of a couple of things that have occurred to me that are actually on the sort of serious side of 50 Shades of Grey. First one is that last night I had my house to myself, which is bliss. It's the first time in a long time I've actually had my house to myself. And I decided to watch Secretary, which I realised as I started reading it, I hadn't really seen since I was about 14, 15, when I was completely in love with it and I watched it obsessively every weekend, but I clearly didn't quite get it then. Now I rewatched it and it's a whole other thing. And it's but anyway, I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to talk about is I don't think that people have mentioned quite enough how much E.L. James sort of ripped it off. First of all, there's the name E. Edward Grey, 50 Shades of Grey, you know, work that out. And there are a couple of other little things that I noticed where I was just like, that, you know, could easily have just been something that she picked up. I'm really just doing this for fun. I like the parallels and I like it when people have stolen and you get to say, hey, you stole from there. So yeah, E. Edward Grey, I mean, that's pretty clear, isn't it? And then there's the food control thing. Okay, so it's like, it's such a sort of passing note in the film, although it does recur, that, you know, that he tells her to eat, like, one scoop of mashed potato and four peas and stuff, and that he's this very particular about. And that in Fifty Shades of Grey, Christian Grey is constantly telling Anastasia Steele to eat, and is being very specific about, you know, what she should eat, and it was in the contract in the first one, whatever. How that sort of in Secretary is just a playful little anecdote, and in 50 Shades of Grey is just this huge deal that almost, I don't know, it's such a big deal. So I thought that was a little disturbing, that the playfully dominant, submissive thing between two consenting adults could be misused to turn into this character of Christian Grey, who is obsessively overbearing and jealous and just a horrible person. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of disturbing, I think. I'm just looking at my notes here, and the other thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of 50 Shades of Grey and Secretary is shame, apparently, but I cannot remember where that comes into it. So clearly there's some misrepresentation of shame which is being ripped off from Secretary and misunderstood, but I can't cite it for you because I have no idea what my notes mean. Told you it would be a bit scatty. So the other thing that I was thinking about in terms of 50 Shades of Grey, I was reading Molly of Molly's Daily Kiss has this anonymous blog where she lets anybody submit anything and it gets published there anonymously, which is a really great thing, by the way. If anyone needs to get something off their chest, that is a great place to do it. There's a really supportive group of people who read it. I read it. I can be reasonably supportive. Anyway, and there was someone who wrote this piece, which is actually, it was quite funny. And it was about it was a real life, you know, sort of anecdote about this girl who was reading 50 Shades of Grey, really wanted her boyfriend to bring out a little bit of the dominant submission stuff. And he was clearly very dominant, but very unwilling to do it with a partner who didn't know what she was getting herself into. Anyways, she eventually persuaded him to get into that more dominant role with her, and she couldn't handle it, and she got angry and upset, and that he'd shifted into his 50 Shades of Grey side. The story itself is, you know, it's fine, it's nothing. What it made me think about was, I think that lots of people have this sort of desire, I think, in, it's really hard to put, basically I can relate to it, so this is why I'm putting it like this, is this desire to be whatever is popular in the world, you know. I think everyone has that. It's mostly something that you go through when you're a teenager, I think, where you desperately want to like the things that are popular because they're popular, and you'll be popular by proxy, you know, that kind of thing. I was thinking about the 50 Shades of Grey and wondering if, while it may be liberating some people and allowing people to explore their kinks, that there might actually be a small number of people out there who are now pretending to be submissive and are sort of, you know, gritting their teeth while they're being spanked because they don't like it, but they think that they're supposed to like it because it's progressive, or that, you know, it's the thing that's done now. And I just was wondering, with a book like this where kink is not that well displayed, and people are going to want to relate to those characters, if that's not going to be a little bit damaging, not only to the people pretending to be submissive and masochistic, but to people who are actually submissive and masochistic, because all it's doing is feeding a whole group of people who don't really know what they want and won't be able to represent what it actually feels like to want to be hurt. So, I don't know, it was on my mind, I thought I should voice it. I'm a bit nervous, to be honest, about how this is all being portrayed. But on to the fun side of Fifty Shades, okay? The great thing that has now come from Fifty Shades is a huge amount of comedy, which I am enjoying so much that I am actually reading. I've read the second one and I am reading the third one. Basically, the reason that I'm reading them is, first of all, I have a sort of know your enemy attitude towards it because I'm an erotic fiction author and I feel like I should know what it's about. I probably knew enough from the first one, but I want to have the whole picture. The other reason that I'm reading it is that I came across these fantastic reviews on Goodreads by Katrina Lumsden of the books, and they are so funny that it's worth reading 500 pages of crap in order to have 15 minutes of laughter. I'm basically reading them so that I can get the most out of those reviews. So on my site, itgirlragdoll.com, there is I will put a list of the best sort of 50 Shades of Grey humour and things that I've found and enjoyed and I just would love other people to enjoy. So we have the reviews by Katrina Lumsden. There is also now, which I was so thrilled to discover, there is a 50 Shades of Grey lorem ipsum text generator, which I have yet to really look into, but I like this. I like it a lot. And the other thing that keeps being sent to me, which I think everyone has seen now, but in case you haven't, is the parody audiobook of 50 Shades of Grey, read by Gilbert Gottfried. You know, there's just a little trailer for it, and I think it's just hysterically funny, and my mother does too, and she hasn't read them, so that's a good endorsement. So I thought I would wrap up this little 50 Shades rant by reading you a little extract from 50 Shades Freed, which is the third book, because it's so bizarre and it made me laugh so much. So, oh my, the look he gives me could be solely responsible for global warming. I pick up my gin and drain the glass, not taking my eyes off him. His mouth drops open and I glimpse the tip of his tongue between his teeth. He smiles lewdly at me. In one fluid move, he stands and bends over me, resting his hands on the arms of my chair. I'm going to make an example of you. Come, don't pee, he whispers in my ear. I gasp. Don't pee? How rude. My subconscious looks up from her book, The Complete Works of Charles Dickens, Volume 1, with alarm. So as you can hear, the comedy kind of writes itself. But on to better things. So, Erotic Meet, Creative Artists, which is a group of, it's sort of a community centre for erotic creative artists, and I'm part of it. Their sort of main group is in London, and they do a social evening every couple of months, and they have mixed media lunch meets and writing meets and things. They're really good if you're in London, really inspiring, interesting, great conversation, great people to talk to. But on their site, which is eroticmeet.net, there is a members lounge, which is just forums, and one of the topics is a weekly question, and I'm one of, I think, four or five questioners who provide questions on that thread, and people are just invited to answer it with whatever they want. The questions are quite interesting, they're fun to answer. So I was asked to ask a question this week, and I asked about the difference between pornography and erotic fiction. It's come up a few times in the last few months actually, both online and people that I've talked to in person. In fact, I went to an erotic meet, mixed media lunch the other day, and it came up. And it's interesting that people have lots of different definitions about what the difference actually is between pornography and erotic fiction. You know, some people think that it's about, I think someone answered the question saying that erotic fiction wakes up your mind and then it arouses you, and that pornography wakes up your arousal and then it makes you think. Yes, for others it's about intention. You know, if the artist was trying to create erotic fiction, then that's what it is, and if they were trying to create pornography, then that's what it is. It's a little bit more difficult, I think, that definition, if you're talking about paintings or drawings, than it is with written literature. Remittance Girl seems to suggest that the difference is in conflict. So if a story has conflict in it and is difficult and engages that more cerebral part of you that deals with conflict, that it's then erotic fiction, because, and I kind of quote, who wants conflict in their pornography? I think that's, for the most part, is quite a good sort of yardstick by how to measure that. I certainly don't want conflict in my pornography. So I've asked about this a lot, and I've talked to people about it, but I haven't really put out my thoughts on it. So I thought that I would mention it here and get to have a little talk about it. For me, I mean, I think the problem with the question is that it seems to suggest that one is better than the other, and obviously seems to suggest that erotica is better than pornography. You know, it's more highbrow and thus more valid. I don't think that's really true. I think that if we say that as erotic artists, that we're going to really undermine our whole view as saying that sex is something worth talking about. Okay, if sex is something worth talking about, then arousal is something that is worthwhile, which means that pornography is worthwhile because it is there to cause arousal. I have a Bill Hicks quote in my head now about the definition of pornography being no artistic merit and causes sexual thought. Oh, which is obviously not quite right, because actually I've seen a lot of pornography that does have artistic merit. But I do think that it has to do with this awakening of mind over arousal or with arousal. I think that if you know, if I go and look for pornography, I am not looking to have my thoughts stimulated. I am looking to have my arousal stimulated. I want to just be turned on. That is why I'm there. If I'm reading erotic fiction, it's because I want to read a literature that is not afraid to deal with sexuality, that confronts it, because it's so left out of most literature. We need erotic fiction because it deals with this really innate part of being human, which is otherwise really ignored, except in pornography. But then in pornography, it's not there for you to think about it, it's there for you to enjoy. And both are completely worthwhile and equally difficult to produce, actually. You know, good porn is hard to find and harder to make. And good erotic fiction is just as difficult. So I really do think that it has this definition of whether it's cerebral or not. But I also think that it's something that is good to keep talking about. And it is really good to make that point about, you know, pornography being just as valid as erotic fiction. Just because it's not stimulating you mentally doesn't mean that it hasn't got a really worthwhile place in erotic art and erotic life. It's a fundamental part of being human. There's been pornography since as early as you can think of, so it's like one of the oldest traditions. So let's show it that respect. Keep this conversation going, because I think it's really interesting and it's really important. The other thing that erotic meat does, or one of the many other things that it does, is competitions. And I don't tend to get involved in the competitions much, just because I have enough projects going on, and I think that what they do really, really well is they inspire people to create work. And actually, if I'm inspired, then I'll be creating work myself on my own time. So I don't tend to participate in the competitions. But last weekend, I was bored and feeling inspirationless, and I looked at the erotic meat site, and the July-August competition was open. I think I only had about 8 hours or something, so I looked at it and I was like, okay, no way I have time for that, and I don't have any ideas. But after a little while of having it in my mind, I thought it might be really fun to play around with my recording software and do something fun with that. So I did. And the prompt for the competition was first times, and it was basically to try and inspire you to do something new and to try something you've never tried before and capture it and create this new art with it. So what I did was I recorded a sort of me whispering a piece that I wrote called I Do Not Lust for Difficulty over a piece of dark piano music that I found on the public domain, and I played around with it and stuff, and I entered it and I won. So I thought that since I, you know, have the podcast, that I would play it for you now. I should tell you that it's really melodramatic, and I laughed the whole time that I was recording it. I'm not apologising for it or anything, I'm just saying that, I had so much fun recording it, and I think that it's a funny, strange little thing, and I hope that you enjoy it. So this is my entry to the Erotic Meat First Time Competition.
He likes to make me cry. I don't mean with pain, which he likes as well, but by making life difficult, making life overwhelmingly complex. He likes me emotionally torn. He likes me confused and upset. He likes crazy women. He likes teasing. He likes to trip up my peace. When I was ruined, it made him hard. So I drew a line.
Stand here or here.
And told him there was no in between. Stood up, got off my knees, didn't call him by that name he gave me. Looked up into his eyes and only had to tilt my head back an inch or two to look up at him. He couldn't decide. Stepped onto one side.
Side.
Which
side?
Happy?
No.
No.
Me neither.
He placed one foot on the other side, yeah, but couldn't commit his body to that inevitability. He wouldn't make me promises. He got distracted and walked away and looked back over his shoulder at me. It was clear nothing over there was holding him. I was pushing. I was crying. He didn't show concern, but he looked.
I'm not crying for you. I know.
He walked back, stood in front of me with his arms crossed. He looked into my eyes, fed me little white lies to delay his truth. He ran out of words and offered it covered.
There's more, but I can't tell you here.
I looked around. Where else did we exist? I felt knots in my stomach. Sweet, deep conflict that answered all my questions. I grinned in my entire contorted body and saw some release.
Then it's too complicated, isn't it?
My turn to leave. At home, I held a glass and wondered how much pressure it would take to break into shards in my palm. I stared with my eyes and cast drama aside. Back in my chair, I buttoned my knees and dipped two delicate fingers into my heat. The knots melted. My temperature rose. I breathed into every deep. I twisted all my hands. I penetrated my soul. I took control of everything I knew so fully. And how deeply I had been controlled by his intangible desires. The freedom made me calm. Unlike him, I do not lust for difficulty. I lust for the end.
Strange, fun to record. So yeah, as I mentioned, I won the first time competition. I don't think I've ever won a competition through Erotic Meat before, so that was kind of a thrill to wake up to. I didn't really record it thinking about winning. I just recorded it thinking about having fun, which I did, and it paid off. So my prize was the heel-o-ring strap-on harness, which is sort of a black stretchy thing that goes on your foot, and you can put a dildo into it on the heel, I guess so that you can fuck yourself with your foot, which is kind of, I think it's one of those strange things that kind of had to be created under the, what is it, rule 404 of the internet, you know. But it's really good fun. It's really strange. I have to admit that I haven't used it yet, and I don't know if it'll fit with any of my toys, but I thought that I should give it a shout out. It is from justpleasure.me, and they obviously support Erotic Meat, so I'm giving them this little review. The harness itself is it's really really functional, which is so nice, you know. It just works. It's not frilly or pink or anything. It is purely for use, and it actually looks quite nice in that sort of meant to be used kind of way. It seems to work. It fits my foot. I'm pretty happy, and it's something a little bit strange. I don't think everyone has a strap-on harness for their foot in their toy box. So, I look forward to using it properly. I'm wondering if, in order to use it properly, I might need to start doing yoga a bit more. But I'm probably bendy enough. Either that, I could just use a really, really big dildo. As usual, to finish off this podcast, I'm going to read something. I'm actually getting to a point now, as I'm becoming more selective, where I go through my archives and there are very few things that I want to read. Just because I either feel they're not the right tone for the podcast or that they're not something that would particularly benefit from being out loud. If anyone disagrees with me and can think of a particular piece in their head, or if someone else has written something and they would like me to read it, please do get in touch with me. You can email me on harper@itgirlragdoll.com. And I really, you know, at this point I just want requests, because I'd like to create a podcast that people want to listen to, you know. Anyway, this week I do have something to read. And this is a sort of strange erotic poem that I wrote in May of last year called The Minotaur. There's very little from, you know, last year and the year before that I've written that I actually still like, and this is one of those rare pieces that I do still quite like, and I'm surprised that I haven't read it out loud before, because I think that with poetry, very often it sounds and sort of comes across better if it's being read. So that's what I'm going to do. So for your listening pleasure, here is The Minotaur. Ice on ice, grey on grey, barefoot on the silken stone, the sacrificial bodies, sick as sin, shook in their sheets, and only one pure face dared raise her chin and gaze upon the vast stone wall of the fortress-like labyrinth. So high, so impenetrable, it took her gentle breath away, made the tender air ragged, but she didn't cry, never a tear nor a sob, whilst her fellow victims wept pebbles rattled on the stone beneath the soles of doomed souls. The fortress of her eyes consoled her captors, who forced strong hands to push forward her comrades, but let her take, stride, by her own will, step by step, the crude stairs. Gaze upturned, all amazed by the grandeur of a place of such terror, she forgot to look upon the floor, passed by the fears of spat-out bones, the sight of which caused the rest to quiver in their skins. She stumbled and bloodied her feet, and the jeering laughs of soldiers told her she was bait, The creature would smell her spilled, heated essence and tear her limb from limb. Too late to cry for mercy. The sisters had wept, to no avail. Begged on their knees, grazed palms, scuffed shins, torn nails from the root on the rough, ragged rock floor of the courtroom. Yet here they stood, front and centre, clasping clasped hands, tears streaming, forced towards the gaping, monstrous mouth of the maze. Quietly she went, into the dark with fortitude, in possession of her wits, and adamant that these final hours would be passed in silent reverence. First cloaked in blackness, the sister's sobs echoed coldly, crushing hope from the hopeless, and she observed the tragedy of Minos's men reduced to the under-the-bed fears of childhood. The golden youth, recognized by the melodious tones of his minstrel voice, called for the 14 to cling together. There is safety in numbers. But his wishes were dashed by the cutting remarks of the raven-haired seductress. Only number one concerned her. Together, were the creature to find one, he would find all. And thus they divided. She stayed with those who remained, the others nothing but footsteps retreating to deadly sanctuary alone. The silence dripped around the soul-crushing tears, and she breathed prayer over her despairing companions. Considering, time to think was plenty, she concluded that her peaceful resolve put to rest the heart that ought to be thundering, in unison, against those royal hallway walls. They wandered lonely together, seeking solace in a jail built by a stepfather for his least-loved son. The sorrow-seeped walls permeated her soul, and she began to think tenderly, deeply of her ferocious captor. As eyes grew accustomed, they began to see, and regretted that they could. Grey from grey distilled before them, and their feet dragged heavier in Xanadu's kingdom. Around corners and corners and corners, doubled back and stitched twice over, wound round and twisted, the group finally came to a standstill. An empty alcove arched cold housed them in their last exhaustion. Laying her head on granite, she fell far to dreams. Images of angels, cherubim, seraphim, standing, 13 around her resting place, guardians of her peace, saviours of her blameless soul. Feathered wings brushed her skin, soft, comforting, close, but became rough, firmer, wetter, air acrid, each touch less pleasant, more undesirable than the last. Peeling her eyes open, she looked into yellow irises. Breath already gone, she could not gasp, only gaze into fate's jaundiced face. The light of angels, so it seemed, illuminated all his glory. Deformed, repugnant ugliness, vast and huge in his frame, flecked with hair, filthy, sinful, foul of flesh. Supine sacrifice was pressed to ground beneath the beast, whose breath, emitted from fist-broad nostrils, steamed on her fresh skin, left pestilent vapours in streams across her face. As his nose wrinkled, drawing in every vine of smell his prey produced, she was sweet on the ground, life in the form of pale purity. Her body didn't move, did not recoil from his hideous form, did not clamp eyes and mouth shut against his repulsive breath, and the creature was moved to curiosity. Towering high above her, she saw ivory horns, stained with blood, dull and shining wet, move solidly, and thought of death, of being run through, penetrated, impaled on his power. Blood-stained, blood-thirsty bull's head hovered above her, smelled her with its carnality. With great courage she drew a lungful of putrid breath, only to have it snatched by screams when, raised before her till then, calmed expression, was the hand of a man, large and rough but utterly human, skin and flesh and pink in the lines of palms, tiny hairs soft as down, nails torn, not cut, but nails nonetheless, not hooves, nor claws, nor talons, or any other reach pertaining to animal. His touch was undoubtedly untamed, masculine, but more, commanding, overbearingly close, original in his illiteracy, but that of a man, exploratory and possessive. She was, after all, his prey, perfect in ceremonial robes of sacrificial white. Palm either side of her open face, he raised himself higher, and into her view came broad, broad shoulders, strong and muscular and frightening as they moved minutely, pulsing power. She bit her lips to stop her mouth as the great head pulled down, traversing the curves of her body. Sniffing loud, he smelled the pits of her arms, the indent of her navel through paper-thin fabric, travelled down and paused momentarily above her pubic mound. She shivered, wished herself unknowing, and threw her gaze about the alcove. Shock, but not surprise, filtered into her mystified mind as she cast eyes across the mangled and mutilated, ripped and ravaged bodies of her 13 companions. Myth, legend, fable, old wives' tale, poor, luckless souls. Far removed from mourning, she shut her eyes, and most unhappy to gaze upon the corpses of those she could not have known. Attention moved her to the beast, whose nose she felt pressed, hot-breathed, into the space between her thighs. She writhed at his intentions, and felt his press firmer there. But the fabric moved him to confusion, and he slid down, down to her toes. He smelled blood between them, and his great tongue extended to lick, long and slow, and push apart the tiny toes of her fairy-like feet. Cow's tongue dug and rubbed rough the filthy soles, creeping between each toe to wet and wet his appetite. Trailing languid licks, delirious in her danger, she opened her pink lips and let slip one momentary drop of laughter. Its carefree echo echoed hollowly. It was not fear, 'twas abandon. Loss and long-awaited blitheness. She settled, foot raised in his man's hand, and allowed his animal tongue to pedicure her feet. Bizarre beyond bizarre, she had lost sight of fear and all his brothers, and raised her torso up on her weightless arms to see her never-thought-of toes, adored by the most hated. When they glistened white, he sniffed again, and crawled towards her, head lowered, following the ever-alluring scent of her intact virginity. The best of unwed girls had been Minos's decree. Strengthless with curiosity, she made limp her legs and allowed his massive head to force wide her thighs. Robe rode up about her waifish waist and openly exposed the creature was her pulsing, untouched centre. No longer afraid, the huge lick of his first tongue did not dismay her unlearned mind. Not once had her mother done her duty and schooled her daughter in the basest of human intimacies. Her daughter knew not shame, knew not why she wore clothes, hid her body, but that she did not hide it when she swam in the river. So it was that she opened the beast, spread wide her thighs, and allowed herself to find pleasure in his carnal touch. Nothing human was there in this bull's head, on his rough tongue, nor his lipless mouth. Unmeaning, she tipped back her head, raised chin to ceiling, and moaned as he devoured her cunt with warm, wet caresses. Pleasure overflowed, and the wetness grew warm until she could only imagine that it came from her, from this untouched place of supposed sin. Waving sanity farewell, she smiled desire between the valley of her legs, and as the beast raised his enormous head, he appeared no more threatening than the animals she named pets before the hearth. Swimming head around fixed eyes, she reached down and stroked the shocking fur of his head betwixt ears and horns. Nose raised, his eyes shut slowly. Did she imagine the satisfaction in his close-eyed expression? No way to tell. Still, she delighted in the animal's happiness, and delighted again when the roughness of his tongue returned to pleasure her incited sex. Trembling in his human hands, she covered his fingers in her palms and pressed her centre forward, offering her engorged clitoris into the gaping mouth of forgotten danger. Time passed, slow and fast, as this ever-field animal brought her again and again to shuddering heights, the like of which she had never known, and in her sweet innocence believed no one but she and Pasiphae had ever felt. By her 13th trembling climax, her feet were balanced precariously on the shoulder blades of the passive creature, and it took the simple pressing of them into his human back to rouse him from his feeding. Able to overpower her at a moment's notice, she tipped his submitting form onto his back, rolled over, and smiled delight to see the aching pinnacle of his manhood, upright and strong in want of satisfaction. Horns reached 3 foot, laying across the silvered floor, so huge and now under her power. Rocking forth, she stalked to cover his massive frame, on hands and knees, crawling to him. Thighs astride his waist, beauty taming the beast, she wrapped her tiny hand around his heated cock and smoothed it silken in her palm. The creature snorted and steamed beneath her touch, arched and threatened to keel her to her back, but she saw deep into his eyes, and placing a palm above his human heart, she tamed the beast as she slid her heated, dripping cunt down onto him. Controlled convulsions rolled through him as he pierced the intact skin of her bloody chastity. She rode him like the oarsman that had pushed back and forth, bringing her across the sea from Knossos to her final oblation. Left alone in deepest solitude with the bestiality-born son of noblemen, she cast away her cares and crested waves of queer copulation. Love-making sullied to pure submission, he arched and asked in groans for the apex of pleasure. Poising both hands on his chest, she granted his wish, and the beast emptied his white-hot seed into her impaled womb, stirring them both by the same strength, shuddering in unison. Together they lived in that sacrificial temple. He licked and scratched filth from the crevices of her body and defiled her endless lust. He fed her sustenance in the dark, and she thought better than to ever gaze upon his meagre offerings, preferring her survival to be secret. And so they ought to have lived, mistress served by obedient pet, for the rest of their dark lives, in that impenetrable fortress of purpose-built confusion. This has been an It Girl Ragdoll podcast. For other episodes or to read more of my work, please visit www.itgirlragdoll.com. Thank you for listening.